The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Chris Denson. Chris is an award-winning innovator, marketer, recovering comedian, and the host of the Innovation Crush podcast, which has more than 700,000 subscribers worldwide. He's been featured in Adweek, Forbes, The New York Times, and Inc. He currently works with several Fortune 500 companies, helping them build their futures. He is the author of Crushing the Box, 10 Essential Rules for Breaking Essential Rules. Chris Denson, welcome to the show.
Woo! I don't know who you're describing. That guy sounded awesome.
He does sound awesome.
Me, unfortunately, this time.
So this is the way I wanted to start this, because given that both of us have backgrounds in comedy and the arts in general, and we both made pivots towards this innovation space, I want to start our conversation by talking about why an arts background is such good bedding for work in a variety of fields. And you write in your book, quote, "Stand-up was a great platform for immediate feedback and validation, and writing was a place to imagine creating any world where anything could happen." So what is it about comedy and arts that is so crucial when you want to be an innovator?
I think that last part is just being able to create and imagine a world where anything's possible. You know, I think when you sit in a, you know, in a brainstorm session, that's what you're doing. You're just dreaming up stuff. I think conversely with the creative process, it's the same thing, right? It's just, you're tapping into something and you get into a flow and into a zone. And then the next thing you know, you kind of look up and you're like, oh, that's what I created. And you know, and then, of course there's the harder skills, like that immediate feedback and validation. You know, sometimes that feedback is not validation
right.
or validation of something that you don't, you know, you would rather not hear. So, you know, feedback is just a big part of the whole creative and business, the innovation process, I'll say. And I think both crafts are just really, like, you know, subjective, at least in the beginning, until you start to prove it. You know, the more unique your style or your approach, the more questions and scratched heads you'll get at the beginning, until somehow, hopefully, it catches on. So there's a plethora of it's parallel between those two worlds.
Yeah, you write in your book of yourself, you say, "I'm simultaneously an outsider and an insider." And I think that's a big thing because artists and comedians are observers of the world, and then they're translators of that world. And they can't, you know, they can't get across their translation if they're not getting back stuff from an audience. So you're already in sort of a dualistic space.
Oh my gosh, yes. I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine yesterday about Jerry Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. And yes, we know the show, we know him as a stand-up, but just watching Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, you see that he is like the way he ponders things and the things he points out that are so mundane, and you go like, yeah, why is it like that? Right? Like this. Mm-hmm. And it's such minutia, but it does make it, you know, it's made seasons of two shows between Curb Your Enthusiasm and Seinfeld, but just his entire career has been built on this. And I think, similarly, in the innovation space, it is that sort of like, hey, why is that like that?
Right.
And no one else thought to even see it that way. And then people go, yeah, why is it that
mm-hmm.
way? You know, the comedy world, it's laughter and it's that sort of that Me Too haha moment.
Yeah.
But, you know, in business, it is the same thing. It's like, Me Too. I want to, you know, that's a problem that I experience and would rather not have.
Yeah,
it's and that's an amazing solution.
Right, it's that link that there's some neuroscience that shows us that an insight is like getting a joke. The same kind of thing is happening in the brain. So it's not a big shift to realize that the reason we're laughing at something is because it's a pattern interrupted. It's divergent thinking in play, and that's exactly what people want when they want people to be creative at work.
Yeah, it's the aha moment, right?
Yeah.
There was a session that I heard once that I loved, and it was called From Haha to Aha.
Yep.
And it's exactly sort of this blend of conversation that we're talking about, which is comedy meets innovation. And it is that same eureka or I get it now. Something clicks and I'm also just a big fan of not innovation as the final product, but the process.
Yeah.
You know, and that muscle of staying in this, you know, constant state of aha. Like, I love layered humor, you know, where it's just like, oh, that was three jokes in one.
Yeah.
And it's just because that individual, whoever's delivering that, has just been adept at just layering in those innovations into the stories that they're telling or the observations that they've seen.
I think that's why so many people are excited about Hannah Gadsby and her Netflix special Net, because it's all that. She is both doing comedy, deconstructing comedy, and talking about identity. Three different comedic moments and dramatic moments that are all going on at the same time.
Oh my gosh, yes. Funny enough, I mean, that's kind of like that reminds me of sort of this wave of what I've been calling like emo comedy. But, you know, it's dualistic or in that sense, triplistic, right? It's the Chris Gethard who will tell you like heart-wrenching stories about depression and medication.
Yeah.
What's Dave Chappelle's writing partner's name? Neil Brennan. Yeah, and it's like three mics. He's like, oh, he gave you three acts in 1 hour like that were all completely different from one another.
Same tag.
I think even from a personal standpoint, that is truly embracing all your sides. And, you know, I'm sure at Second City, it's like you have to tap into multiple versions of yourself as a performer and, you know, and responding to feedback and those yes and moments. And like, I wouldn't normally do that, but my character would.
Right.
You know, so it's that sort of, but the character is still part of you. And
right.
I think it's the same thing. That's why I can work with like a Wells Fargo or Nike or an art exhibition and kind of like all those things feed each other from a creative standpoint, you know, at least in the sort of creative gymnastics that happen in my brain, I guess.
That, you know, so you bring up something, this wasn't on my list of questions, but I think it's interesting because you talk about the ability to wear a character, and certainly at Second City, we talk about wearing that character lightly because we're always wanting it to be kind of close to ourselves. That's our comedic style. And I think in business, people somehow forget that they are all the time playing a character of themselves. And by the way, that character maybe needs to change if the context is different so that you can be heard, so that you can be most effective. And that doesn't mean you're being inauthentic. It's just adjusting your mindset and your presentation. And something that in the arts we're very, used to, but somehow feels unnatural in the business setting.
It does. It's the one sort of parallel I draw is with that is sort of reading the room.
Yes.
Right. It's kind of like, oh, the dick jokes don't work, but the parenting joke works. And
right.
So now I'm going to go down that path.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. And, you know, I think most of us get in a business sense, we get and say, like, here's the product. Here's the idea. We're pitching it and we're having this conversation. You've done that a dozen times, but you're not really looking at whose eyes are glazed over, who scratched their head and a little bit of confusion. Who's nodding off or who's like actually leaned in to a point. And I think that gives you direction to like, oh, that person's excited. Now I'm going to match their level of engagement and like go, you know, in with that in that direction. And it's not you made a great point, which is not sort of selling out or not being yourself. You know, we're all dynamic individuals. You know, I've been in pitches where somebody's like, they're receiving the information like this, and here's this company, this is what we do. And I find myself doing the same thing.
Yeah, matching.
Right. But, you know, it's that ability. I think we're all salespeople. We're all marketers of some sort. You know, your LinkedIn profile is a marketing tool, right?
Right.
So, I think in order to do that, you have to do things that resonate with the people that you are trying to reach. And they vary from person to person, but they all fit under an umbrella, you know, depending on what that product or service is.
So one of the great things about your book, and I really enjoyed it, and part of it was you have some observations about business culture and teams and marketing that I think, A, are very fresh, but and B, very much jive with sort of the improv mindset of how we approach business. And I want to talk about what you think about teams. And a quote from your book, you say, quote, "When I hire for innovation teams today, the type of misfit toys I look for are oddball polymaths who have experimented in many areas of business and creativity." So you're talking about sort of diversity writ large, and that's the best thing for your team, right?
Oh my God. Yes. It's probably one of my favorite things. It's really like, and I know in today's climate, we talk a lot about diversity and inclusion, and we do touch on that a little bit in the book, but mm-hmm. I think even with that being said, the bigger reason you want that is you want diversity of thought.
Yeah.
Right? You want diversity of thought when you come into a room. If, you know, Bank of America has a problem, I would love to be in a room with a scientist and a marketer and an artist and, you know, a 14-year-old who's about to get a bank account, right? And just mm-hmm. kind of like, let's see what happens, because I think these different voices are going to approach the problem differently, right? If you look at whatever, the 20 years of history or 30 or 40, however old those people are, and, you know, their lives have literally led them to that point in time. Mm-hmm. And all that experience matters, the good, the bad, the ugly, the professional observation, the, you know, my experience with that product or service means this. And of course, you got the data points and the, like, all the other business things you need. But it's so much more valuable because, you know, I think if you get a homogenous team, you're going to come up with homogenous solutions. You know, I can tell you a number of times I've been in brainstorms and, you know, somebody would be like, BuzzFeed quiz. And yeah. it's like over, and that same person is saying BuzzFeed quiz. And, you know, so, and that, not that that's a bad thing. I think that's where sort of I use my sort of comedy upbringing, and that's where the yes and comes. So mm-hmm. you do need the BuzzFeed quiz person in there, because that, then you're going to have to iterate on and innovate on the idea of what a BuzzFeed could actually do. And maybe right. it becomes an Alexa-enabled BuzzFeed quiz. And so now you actually have a vocal version of it via, you know, a device in Amazon and so on and so forth. So
yeah.
it's important.
Yeah, and diversity and inclusion, it definitely the way you talk about it and the way we talk about it, is broader than skin color. It is a gender, of course, but more than that. I had a colleague who was talking to Ernst & Young and met someone there whose job it is to hire people on the autism spectrum. And I was like, that's great. And I'm flashing back, realizing, like, how many Second City folks who we just thought were a little odd were probably on the spectrum.
Right.
Right. And you two probably common yeah. friends.
Yeah, no, of course. I was with my manager yesterday for a quick second, and she's with another client. And I was like, that guy's an oddball. But then come to find out, he's like a musical genius, right?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
And of course, like, I would love to be in the room with him and have a conversation and see what we can create. There is that sort of thing. I have a 13-year-old daughter who's interested in medicine, and we watched The Good Doctor, mm-hmm. which is about it's an ABC series about a doctor who is on the spectrum. He's young. He's just, you know, is in residency. But, you know, to see how he approaches some of the problems, because he's like almost OCD about symptoms and results and potential consequences and so on and so forth. So he's valuable, but it's also, it's weird and off-putting to the rest of the staff sometimes. So there's right. like that, there's your dramatic tension, I guess. But I think you need that same tension in, you know, in a team as well.
Yep. So. Yep. All right. There's another thing that you talk about, and I titled it the success problem. And we've talked about expertise syndrome on this podcast, that companies, especially when they're doing well, and you say sort of when they're chugging along and succeeding in the marketplace, they tend to assume that they know everything, they know their audience, they've got it. And that is maybe, success is like the worst place from which you can then leap off and innovate.
Oh, yes. I was going to say, I couldn't agree with you more, but I wrote it.
Yes.
that is such a great insight.
of mine.
you're absolutely right. It's It's such an integral part. Sure. No, absolutely. It's kind of just keeping that sense of naivete with you. I think the success is not bad, not a bad thing, and not a bad thing to build off of. But I think keeping that spirit of, you know, being naive and I don't like we're starting over every time, you know, is that's the spirit of what innovation is. It's like, how do we evolve? What we did last year was great. Let's not do it again, which is what most of us do. Or just even and how we interact with family members. It's like, we always eat this meal on Tuesday, you know, and it works. Nobody complains about the meal. So, but that one day you get like, oh my gosh, this is the best pizza. Where did we find this pizza? And then that just sparks a whole new thing. So it's really about maintaining that spirit of exploration and experimentation and evolution, rather than and again the success is great, but it's like, what do you do with it, right? Can you does that success lead you to, you know, new resources? Or it's not so much, yeah, we celebrate the accolades and the awards and sure, but all that stuff is fine, but it's really like, where do you go from there, and keeping that question in your head, where do we go from here?
And I think the thing that especially established companies have to do for their employees is give them experiences, give them nudges, hacks to push them into new sort of uncomfortable spaces from which to work. And I think about directors at Second City who have basically said, all right, during this process, this creative process, putting up a show, everyone needs to learn a new instrument because you are going to play it on stage. And just the process of doing that has sort of brought new stuff to the fore. Oh, I remember John Cougar Mellencamp did that for his band because he wanted to sort of refresh everyone's attitude at one point this many decades ago. So I think that what we have to recognize is that we're all going to fall into those patterns. When you know, when you're a comedian, you have a joke that works, you want to rely on that joke, but then you know you can only tell it so many times because you're going back to the same club. So now you got to try out all this other stuff, fail, you know, have that incredible opportunity to fail so that you can find your success.
Right. No, I had a client at Warner Brothers, and they're like, there's a few ideas that my team would have at OMD that we could go into. They were malleable, right? So let's say we found a new technology, like a augmented storytelling, you know, platform, which I love, called Novel Effects. And as you read, you know, it feeds you audio. It knows where you are in a book or in a story. And as they say, my car is speeding down the street. And then via the audio experience, the car is speeding down the street. Yeah. Right. So that's something that applies in art, film, you know, apparel. Like you could use that in a lot of different ways. And so we had pitched that so many times, and it was like, we were almost getting tired of it. But then you work with a film studio and you go like, okay, it could work on this film. It could work on that film. It could work. And suddenly they're like, you know what? Their perception was that we were being repetitive.
Yeah,
but really, and it's the same problem with that joke, right? It's a great joke. It's just like, this is a great platform, but then I have to find a different way to refresh it or put it aside for a while. You know, as passionate as I am about it, I can't. You know, I have to understand again who my audience is, right? It goes back to that.
So let's talk about that too, because you talk about diving into the culture of an audience, and this is around empathetic communication. I think there's a bit of design thinking in here. And one of the people that you talk about in your book, who I think I'd like you to talk about to our listeners, is this guy, Dan Goods, who is the artist in residence and chief visual strategist at NASA. So what's up with that?
That's my favorite reaction. Is what's up with that? Like, I want to know. You know, I want people to have a little bit of shock and awe. Even that chapter is called "Swim Like an Otter," and the whole idea. And all the chapters have sort of these oddball metaphors. Again, I like to just kind of shock the system a little bit and go like, "Hey, what is that? I didn't sign up for this." So, I want to make people like this. No. So Dan has been at NASA for all 16 years now, as their, you know, for lack of a smaller phrase, is their artist in residence. He helps craft missions. He, you know, redesigns spaces inside of NASA. He works with engineers on their pitches, you know, because they're pitching 10, 20-year missions, and there's only a batch of them to get greenlit every so often. So he's helping them craft, get out of geek speak, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
When he was in art school, he had a professor that said, hey, draw me a picture of an otter, you know, for your assignment. So he did that and turned it in. The professor says, you know what, meet me at the pool tomorrow. And when he gets to the pool, the professor shows him a video of an otter swimming. And he's like, now get in the water and swim like this. Mm-hmm. You know, so this whole idea of empathy, right? I think when we approach a problem for a client, or we have an idea for a particular audience or group of people, or even something that you just want to use for yourself, it's this idea of like, let's go as deep into understanding who these, you know, potential consumers or users are as possible. And, you know, a lot of times we read a couple of blogs and we look at the research and we see the data. And I talk about this idea of like, been there, done that versus be there, do that.
Yeah.
You know, like, especially going back to our earlier conversation about a company that may have been around for 50 years. Like, we know who our audience is. We get it. It's just like, but no, they've evolved. So let's go and spend time, be on the ground, do what they do, go to the festival, be at the mall, just kind of be amongst the crowd. And the example we give in there is like, let's say you have an idea for NASCAR, you know, for a NASCAR experience. It's like, I want to create this experience for NASCAR. But then when you actually go to a NASCAR race, you realize how loud it actually is in real life. You get dust splattered all over you. It takes you an hour to get from your seat to the bathroom to the, you know, concession stand. And, you know, you may very well be solving the wrong problem. It was a great idea, great start. But like, let's go and develop a sense of empathy and connection with whatever the experience is that we're trying to create.
And this is also because experimentation is so crucial. You talked to the head of innovation at Adidas, and I think you asked him, what are your KPIs? And he says, we don't have any. And I loved hearing that because there's so much talk around key performer index and the KPIs and ROI. And like, if you get caught up in ROI, I can tell you, you're not going to be innovating.
Yes. You know, for a while, I would reframe ROI as return on innovation.
That's good.
And it would kind of just reframe it for people because, you know, and I think it's that idea that, you know, yeah, the experiments, you know, a percentage of them may not work, but the ones that do will be well worth the risk. And so in John's case with Adidas, I interviewed them the year they won the Best Innovation Award at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. And they had created a connected soccer ball, which, you know, is something that you kick, and obviously that was redundant. You kick a ball, right? but no, when you kick it, it tells you like how strong your kick is, what part of your foot hit the ball, what was the arc, how far did it go, what was the wind, just all these different data points to actually help someone become a better athlete. And so that was. There was no mandate given for that, right? There was no brief. That was just something that they created. Very similarly is Guy Belouch, who's mentioned in the book, who is the head of L'Oreal Connected Beauty Incubator. And they were the first to create what they called Makeup Genius at the time, which was an augmented reality application that allowed users to try on any of their 300-plus products in their retail. Mm-hmm. So whether you want to do blush or mascara or lipstick or, you know, all those different things, you can do it right there in the app. And they just saw this huge spike of engagement. And it, again, no assignment per se. And I think part of that risk mitigation is also just hiring people or putting people in charge that you know have the best interest of the company at heart. You know, I spent time at PayPal recently in their innovation lab. And the guy who runs it has been at PayPal for 7 years, but he's been running the lab for 2 years. And he did nothing in innovation before then, but he understands the company so well that they're willing to hand over the keys for a little while and go like, all right, let us know what you come up with. Hmm. So there is a little bit of science to it. It's not all like, let's go paint the walls and see what happens. Experimentation with purpose, I suppose.
Yep. Another thing you talk about is the importance of sort of grit and resilience. And you write, quote, the hardships we've survived subconsciously inform how we express our creativity. This is so true because you don't really learn through your successes. You learn through your failures, which means if you want to be a lifelong learner, you're a lifelong failure. And we know this from the comedy world. That's fine. That is what is part of the process. But it applies, I think, in business, and you apply it to your own life and stuff that you've gone through.
Oh my God. Yes. And it's so true. You know, I think we can't ignore the human side of this, right? As much as I can talk all day about business tactics and team structure and brainstorming, at the end of the day, we're all human beings. There's a chapter called Death by a Thousand Slaps,
yeah.
You know, and that's my approach to failure, at least the conversation around it. I feel like there's enough out there about the entrepreneur who lost $10 million or had to move back into their parents' home. But I like to focus on these like everyday annoyances that just happen in life. You know, whether your kid's doing bad at school, you got a flat tire, and that investor hasn't called you back in 3 weeks, and you've emailed them almost every day, and you delivered everything you said you were going to deliver. Like, that is a disheartening set of circumstances to experience all at once. And I think it can sort of scratch away at your creative spirit. And so, you know, I talk about the idea of micro failures, these just small things, smaller, you know, that aren't always business related, but some of them are. And but conversely, there's the micro wins, right? Mm-hmm. Those things that we have done well that we forget to remind ourselves and pat ourselves on the back. I had the honor of I went to Michigan State University, so yeah, I feel you on the Midwest.
Yep.
So, but after the 100th Rose Bowl, which Michigan State won, I interviewed the coach who ironically had also played for Michigan State the last time that they were in the Super Bowl, like in the 80s. Mm-hmm. They weren't in the Super Bowl, the Rose Bowl.
Yep.
And you know, one of their team principles for the entire season was celebrate every win. In fact, that's what I titled that episode of Innovation Crush, was celebrate every win. And they were like, if everybody got to the locker room on time, that was a win. We applauded, we danced, we cheered each other. If, you know, so if somebody got a C instead of a D on their last assignment, like everything was a win.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think as much as those failures can annoy us and distract us, I'll say, I think it's equally as important to be like, hey, actually, you are also really awesome, right?
Yep.
You've gotten this far. And, you know, and so it's an interesting dynamic where we don't give ourselves the credit, or, you know, we're not emotionally aware of how we are interacting or receiving the things that are happening in our lives.
So we're coming close to the end, and I am going to ask you for a yes and story, but there's two other items I want to talk to you about from your book. You have a quote where you say some of the best innovation comes from constraint. So I've been talking about this a lot this week for some reason. And then someone sort of hipped me to Tim Harford's book, Messy. And he has this amazing story. And I don't know if you know about this. The best-selling jazz album for a long while was Keith Jarrett's The Coln Concert. Do you know about this story?
No.
So Keith Jarrett shows up in Köln, Germany, and the piano that they've gotten for him is broken and terrible. And it's a young girl who is trying to call around to get a new piano. And he's like, I can't play this thing. I mean, the pedals were not working. They were really sticky. And both the high end and the low end of the piano were broken. There was keys that he couldn't play. And so she's like, this is the only thing I have. We're sold out. The audience is coming in. And he basically says, okay, in his writer, it says you have to record every concert. He goes, you're going to record, I'm going to go out and play this, and you're going to record this concert, and I'm going to use it as my cautionary tale for what happens when you don't have the right piano. So he goes out, they record the concert. It's incredible. And it's in part because he's forced to use the middle of the piano, which is very melodic. You hear him banging. And so there's all the syncopation that gets used because he's trying to get the pedals to work. And it becomes like this legendary show. And it all came from this because he was so constrained in what he could do. And he had to really innovate inside that space. And I think that's exactly what you were talking about.
Oh my, yes, it's you know, it's a condition that I think we find ourselves in more often than not.
Yeah.
You know, where you don't have the money you thought you wanted, or the amount of time, or the number of people, or whatever wherever your handicap is, and you have to work around it. Like you just, you really have no choice but to work around it because you've exhausted all of your other options. And working around it is probably an understatement. It really requires ingenuity to get whatever it is, the result you want. That example you gave is great because it's like you're up on that stage to perform. And mm-hmm. so, you know, luckily the constraint actually enhanced the performance and it gave that person a new skill set.
Yeah.
There were times where I would get a call on Tuesday, hey, we need ideas by Thursday and they have to be under this amount of money. And we want to be able to execute them by, you know, a month from now.
Yeah.
You're like, well, that is not, that is not an ideal set of circumstances.
No.
And, you know, it's like, well, they don't have any, but like the team will start saying like, almost annoyed, right? Like they always do this or whatever the constraint is. And then, you know, once all that stuff is cleared, we'll be getting to a rhythm and you start to find like where are those avenues that are very inventive because they have to be, as opposed to, I think it was Kevin Smith who said, you know, I make really good $1 million movies. I make really shitty $20 million movies.
Right.
It's too much money. He doesn't know what to do with it.
Yep.
You got a ton of resources. You can have really great talent. Or I can have, what are the two guys, Silent Bob and what's his name? And it's like, they weren't actors, right? Like, but they're iconic characters. He used whatever he could that was around him. And I think we all do that. I grew up in Detroit, and it's one of my sort of favorite, you know, kind of almost rock bottom stories. And if you look at the uptick that's happening in that city right now, it's because they got to a place where the mayor was in prison, yes. not in jail. People had left, buildings were abandoned, and just when you think it couldn't have gotten any worse, it's like, well, what if we, artists started moving in, then they built a tech hub, and then Shinola, started to like be very smart about how they were creating jobs and products. So there's a lot of, I won't say cautionary tales, but just blueprints that have been laid that are out there. Mm-hmm. Just like that story you mentioned about the piano.
Yep. All right. And one more thing before we get to your yes and story. I love this quote. I think I will write it on my wall, which is, quote, freedom to put garbage on the whiteboard is essential.
Yes. Yes. I was just saying this the other day. It's like the brainstorm space should be the safest place in any company.
Yeah.
Even safer than HR, right? It's like, and HR will definitely write down whatever you tell them. So, mm-hmm. but that whiteboard is when you can say, oh, what about socks with holes in them? You're like, that has nothing to do with anything.
But put it on the board.
Put it in. Let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you start to put those things up there and then suddenly a dot or two connects and the sock suddenly makes sense, even though it didn't 20 minutes ago. And maybe the sock doesn't ever make sense and that's okay too. So it's this ability to like be as free thinking as possible and not be afraid to look ridiculous or fail. And there's even exercises that you can do to get, because not everybody's like a professional brainstormer and like, can walk into a room and do that. But there are exercises, and I'm sure you know from the improv world, where it's like, all right, we're going to do a sprint. We're going to take 5 minutes. Everybody write down the worst idea you can think of for this particular issue. Mm-hmm. And they usually become really funny reads. Everybody gets their jitters out. And then the next part of that exercise is, okay, now pick one of those ideas and actually turn it into an awesome idea. Right? So then this exercise is turning something that's not so great into something that's pretty amazing. So, and it's a collaborative effort. Matter of fact, you actually like pass the paper to the left and the one person can pick it. There's different variations of that same exercise.
Yeah.
But, it's using some tactics to create a safe space. And then people get used to it. Then they walk into, the next brainstorm, you might not need the bad idea exercise just because people know that there's no wrong answer.
Yeah, whenever I do stuff with IDEO, they're always making me draw, and I'm so self-conscious about that, and it's like it is upsetting to me, and I'm like, oh, well, this is what we do to other people when we make them get up and, you know, talk and improvise. It's just happening that drawing is the thing I don't like. All right, so we end every podcast with asking our guests to do a yes and story. I recognize this is a tad bit of a layup for you, given what you do, how you think, and the kind of career you've had, but I wonder if you do have a story for us at a time where in your life you might have normally have said no, but instead you said yes and.
Man, like I said, there's so many. I mean, it's kind of been the story of my life, is just kind of like trying to be in flow, and like here we are now, like let's figure out a way to go with it. I think in the context of the book, you know, the BuzzFeed example is a real one. Mm-hmm. You know, like I got to a point where I was like, I felt like I was so, luckily in your world, it's like, there's an immediate thing, right?
Yeah.
In my world, sometimes there's like, you just said that again in my head. Mm-hmm. but then my yes and was, okay, yes. And if we did a BuzzFeed quiz, how can we do it new or differently than anybody else has ever done it? And so my yes and usually involves a question of sorts.
Right.
And then we answer that question. We did actually end up, we didn't do it, but we had this, we built this whole like ecosystem for these Alexa enabled BuzzFeed quiz, especially at a time where Amazon Alexa is still like one of the top, you know, growing devices in people's homes and offices. And the Alexa skills are like getting pretty crazy. And so you'll start to see things that you're familiar with take on new formats in that environment. So, being able to build off something that was really annoying to me at one point, and turn it into something that I felt like super strongly about, and collectively the team felt really strong about it, and it was a group effort. So that's one of the ones that come to mind.
That's great. You can catch Chris Denson on the Innovation Crush podcast, so subscribe to that, and then you can buy the book Crushing the Box. It's terrific. I recommend everyone get it. Chris Denson, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Well, I've been working in a coal mine.